American Maritime Voices was created to help you speak up, show your pride, and when needed, push back. The future of maritime is in your hands, and its story needs to be told. Will you help tell it?
Welcome back to the American Maritime Podcast, powered by Big Wig Podcast. We're glad to have you aboard. I'm your host, Sada Fuentes, and today we are very excited to have Admiral Ann Phillips, the 20th Administrator for the Department of Transportation's Maritime Administration, otherwise known as MARAD. Admiral, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sada. Honored to be here.
Thank you so much. Let's start off by learning a little bit more about the Maritime Administration and how it supports the U.S. Flag Fleet.
Absolutely. So thanks for the opportunity again. I'm really glad to be here to talk about MARAD. You know, our mission is to foster, promote, and develop the maritime industry in the United States to ensure our nation's economic and national security needs are met. We are a relatively small agency, about 830 people. 300 or so are here in Washington, D.C., in the Department of Transportation. 293 are at the Merchant Marine Academy. All of those people are MARAD employees, the professors, the staff, everyone at the academy. The remainder, about 230 or so, are out in our fleet support sites around the country, Norfolk, Virginia, New Orleans and Beaumont, Texas, and Suisun Bay, California. They are managing our fleet support sites. They are managing our ready reserve fleet. And I should also add, we have 10 gateway directors from our Division of Ports and Waterways around the country working with our ports and our waterways directors and associations around the country, helping to ensure that we have good connections and a good understanding of the needs of our maritime industry broadly, inland waterways, coastal waterways, and then our blue water fleet as well.
That's great.
So that's a small portion of what the Maritime Administration does and how many people we have. Of course, you know, we're certainly have a DOD side and a DOT side under the Department of Defense. That's about $830 million of our budget. We run our Ready Reserve Force, our Ready Reserve Fleet, which is between 48 and 50 vessels that are ready in support of TRANSCOM, in support of Department of Defense needs to support Transportation Command. A number of those vessels have been activated over the past year. We can talk more about that later. We also are building new vessels. We are building a national multi-mission support vessel, the NSMV. First ship's been delivered to SUNY Maritime. There are four more coming for the four remaining coastal state maritime academies. That's a vessel construction manager concept, also being run out of MAR 600. And we are acquiring and recapitalizing vessels in support of our ready reserve fleet through a vessel acquisition manager process, also run out of MAR 600. So that's our DOD side in large part. We also maintain our maritime security, tanker security, new tanker security program, and cable fleet security program within the Maritime Administration. On the DOT side, and of course, we have very large grants under the bipartisan infrastructure law supporting recapitalization, resilience, and infrastructure related to our port infrastructure in the United States. So quite a bit going on there. That's just a few things, kind of a snapshot of all the things that we do. But as an operational and a promotional agency, we're a rather small agency to be doing all of these things. So busy times in the Maritime Administration.
Oh, I'm sure. And that is a big mission set for a small number of people. Tell me more about these gateway offices and what you all do nationwide at the ports and at other locations along inland waterways.
So our gateway directors are divided into 10 sectors around the country, and they are our direct connection with ports and waterways around the country. So they'll be working with port operators, with port boards, with industry, with labor to support the needs of our inland waterways, our coastal waterways, and of course our blue water fleet as well. So they're our eyes and ears on the ground. They know the circumstances, the situations, the challenges with low water or high water, the needs of specific industries in certain parts of the country. They can help point people in the right direction within Department of Transportation, looking at for grant opportunities, not only our grants, our Port Infrastructure Development Program, our U.S. Marine Highways Program, and of course our Small Shipyard Grant Program. All of those are opportunities, but there are other grants within DOT that they can assist ports and waterways, operators, directors, managers in considering. And then they also are a terrific source of information for us so that we can best position ourselves to do the most we can for the broad network of inland waterways and coastal waterways around the country. So really important group of folks. And they truly are the eyes and ears of MARAD for the ports and waterways around the country, and in that context also report back from those ports and waterway operators to us on what their needs are and the challenges that they're facing. So really, really critical program and a tremendous value to the Maritime Administration.
Yeah. And value to the taxpayer as well.
Absolutely.
We are a maritime nation. Everyone here depends on our seas, on our rivers, on our inland waterways. So having that kind of feedback coming from those waterways here to the Beltway, to your work here in Washington, sounds critical.
And most of these people, I should add, they are experts in their fields. They've been working in this field. Some of them have sailed as mariners. Some of them have been planners and have worked in ports around the country. So they have a lot of expertise and exposure to the industry broadly, all from different perspectives. But that really helps them communicate and really get to the heart of what industry needs and how we can best position ourselves to help them.
That's great. And earlier you mentioned that MARAD is a promotional agency. This is different from any other agency inside of Department of Transportation. What does that mean in practice? How are you all supporting the U.S. flag fleet?
Well, in large part, we're an operational agency and a promotional agency. So the operational side, of course, is our ready reserve fleet, the 50 vessels that are ready in support of Department of Defense needs under the Transportation Command. But we are also promotional in the context of our mission. We are there to foster, promote, and develop the maritime industry. So we're always looking for ways to advocate on behalf of the industry for the industry's needs, things that will strengthen the industry, building capacity within the industry, and just advocating for and educating the country on what the industry does, how important, and how absolutely vital it is to our economic and national security. So you'll hear me say that a lot. It's a drumbeat. It is our mission, and it's absolutely critical that we do that. So that makes us a little different from other agencies within DOT. We're the only one that has this split funding, which puts us into different kinds of committees for our funding and authorization resources, and we're also working with two different departments, Department of Defense and Department of Transportation, and of course from the operational and promotional perspective, we are advocating for our industry. We're not regulating them; we're advocating on their behalf. So that is a very different perspective and position from some of the other agencies within DOT. Right. That makes us unique.
Yeah, it really does, and also reflects how important maritime is to our nation. MARAD is also also responsible for granting Jones Act waiver requests. Why is it important that that type of authority rests within MARAD?
Well, Jones Act waiver requests are actually granted and overseen by the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. It's the Secretary of Homeland Security who will actually grant waivers. MARAD's role in the Jones Act waiver process is to ascertain whether or not there are qualified Jones Act vessels available to meet whatever requirement the waiver is seeking a waiver for. So are there vessels within U.S. flag that meets Jones Act criteria, which is U.S. built, U.S. owned, U.S. crewed, and operated within the United States that can support this alleged need, whatever request might come in. So a shortage of something, can a Jones Act vessel need it? So we make that determination as to whether or not there is availability. And if there is availability, we pass that back to the Secretary of Homeland Security, who then makes the determination as to whether or not a waiver may be granted. So, but what's important about MARAD's participation here is we maintain constant contact with industry so that we understand where challenges might arise and what kind of availability there is. We are often called by people seeking assistance who aren't to the waiver point yet, where they feel that a waiver would be required, but they need help aligning or coordinating. And because we have that constant communication, we're able to reach out to industry and say, hey, we have a request for this. Can you provide assistance? And so we can kind of help stave off a potential waiver situation in advance. It's not a part of the waiver request process, but it gets to our connection with industry and our close communication with them so that we don't have to get to the point where there might actually be another option or opportunity. Jones Act vessels are available. They can meet the need.
Right. And we always want to go with Jones Act vessels first. And it's great that you all have that constant communication and know what the latest is with industry so you can make sure American companies have the first opportunity. Now let's talk a little bit more about you and your background. You served in the United States Navy, retiring as a Rear Admiral. You also worked on climate change. How is that affecting your perspective and approach to MARAD?
Well, Again, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity and honored to have the opportunity to serve as the 20th Maritime Administrator. I think the fact that I have 31 years of service as a surface warfare officer, commanded a new destroyer, built a new destroyer, oddly enough, have been in a shipyard and in a dry dock on every ship I've ever served on. So that's kind of a unique set of experiences for a surface warfare officer. Not unheard of, but unusual to have done that so many times. As you know, within the Navy, surface warfare officers serve as both engineers and deck officers. We're not limited to one track or another. I've done both. So that gives me a unique perspective. And I've commissioned a new ship. And guess what? We're building new ships. So it's kind of cool to see that process and how it works outside of the way DoD does it. But the fact that I have that experience, I think, is helpful. I've sailed the seven seas and enjoyed it. And I say that rhetorically because I don't think I've been in all seven of them, but spent 31 years at sea, did a lot of international work, spent a lot of time working with other navies and different kinds of stakeholders in the maritime industry in my career. So all of that comes together to help bring some perspective to the industry. I'm not a licensed mariner. Most naval officers are not, but I have that experience. I know what it's like to be at sea and to face the challenges that mariners face broadly. And of course, mariners are all one community, particularly in times of crisis, safety, security. The value of life at sea is something that all mariners share. So that's the maritime side. Mm-hmm. I also, after I retired from the Navy, had an opportunity to become involved in coastal resilience, interestingly enough. Whole new career path, not uncommon for women in the services to shift and do something completely different because we've done so much that's completely different in our lives anyway. And I found my way to have the opportunity and the honor to serve as the first special assistant to the governor of Virginia for coastal adaptation and protection and to be a part of developing Virginia's first coastal resilience master plan. Mm-hmm. So that brings an interesting, unique perspective when it comes to the resilience of coastal challenges and coastal infrastructure. And hey, ports are coastal infrastructure. So this all fits together in the context of, you know, developing ports and waterways, helping them understand what their resilience needs are, understanding myself what their resilience needs might be, and then kind of fitting that into options and opportunities under the Port Infrastructure Development Program. Of course, there are many ways that these grants are evaluated. There's a whole set of criteria in the Notice of Funding Opportunity. The secretary makes the decisions about grants. I don't, but I'm a part of the process. And I think having that background and that exposure to what resilience at ports means, what coastal resilience means, the needs of infrastructure in the context of dealing with all the many challenges that ports deal with and that transportation, other transportation modes deal with as they connect with ports, add some value, I think. And so I'm thrilled to have that opportunity as well. And we have lots of great conversations about how best to serve ports and their needs and interests.
American Maritime Voices was created to help you speak up, show your pride, and when needed, push back. The future of maritime is in your hands, and its story needs to be told. Will you help tell it?
Faith in the news media has been challenged, making it even harder to get stories told. The Friday Reporter podcast was created to help audiences better understand the media by hosting journalists who will answer the questions to which we need answers. Join me every Friday to hear more.
On any given day in Washington, policy proposals are created, debated, and decimated by tens of thousands of people and organizations working behind the scenes. On 80 Proof Politics, a guest and I will visit a D.C. watering hole and distill the art of advocacy by pulling back the curtain a bit and taking a look at how they play their part in the sausage factory we call our federal government. So if you're at all interested in how the sausage is made, pull up a chair, grab a drink, and join us. After all, what goes better with sausage than a tall, cold one?
I also want to note, too, that you're part of a wave of women leaders in maritime. There's yourself at MARAD, Admiral Franchetti at the Navy, right. Admiral Fagan at the Coast Guard, General Van Ovost at Transcom, our own Jennifer Carpenter at American Maritime Partnership. How can industry and government work together to create more opportunities for women leaders in maritime?
Well, certainly, as I'll quote the CNO, Evelisa Franchetti, if you can see it, you can be it. So that's a short way of saying that more women, seeing women in leadership positions gives them the idea, yep, you know what, I can do that. I can do that too. I'll also like to add as a couple of shout outs, though, for innovative women in the industry who are making change in maritime, are our own superintendent of the Merchant Marine Academy, Vice Admiral Joanna Noonan, and the very recently installed superintendent of the Naval Academy, Vice Admiral Yvette David. So two more leaders in maritime now in command of two of our five federal academies, which is tremendously important. And again, a tremendous example for young women on thinking about the industry, on their way up in the industry. So what can be done more broadly is to think broadly about how to recruit, train, retain, and keep mariners in the industry broadly. You know, we have a mariner shortfall. I bet we'll talk a little more about that later. But also, how in particular do we recruit and train and maintain women in the industry? For the maritime industry, 7% of this country's maritime industry is women right now. 54% of the U.S. population is women, so there's definitely a mismatch. Mm-hmm. So how do we get more women into the industry? How do we keep them in the industry? Are there policies that we should change with regard to the industry that would help retain mariners broadly? It turns out that often that policies that help retain women help retain men, too, because they are things that are more focused on quality of life, on different options for people in their career paths, and also ensuring safety and fair treatment at sea. So if I may, I'll shift to safety at sea a bit. Certainly you're aware of MARAD's Embark program. Mm-hmm. All credit to Lucinda Leslie, former deputy acting administrator and deputy administrator, who with a team of stakeholders in response to an egregious report on now known as the Midshipman X case that took place in the fall of 2021 or that was reported in 2021, led to the creation of the Embark program, which is focused on safety at sea for cadets specifically, but really long-term for safety at sea for all mariners, to ensure that mariners are respected, treated based on their professionalism and skill and their knowledge, skills, and abilities, and not bullied, harassed, sexually harassed, or assaulted as a part of their service or during the course of their service. So Embark became a policy in December 2021. December of 2022, we began having carriers enroll, which was a requirement to essentially set up a sexual assault prevention and response program to ensure the safety of cadets at sea, again, leading to the safety of all mariners. In 2023 NDAA, which was December 23rd, I think, of 2022, Embark became law. So Embark is now the law of the land. We have 19 carriers enrolled. 16 are required. 3 others have joined. We're working through applications from a few more U.S. flag carriers who have traditionally carried midshipmen. And we are working through a rulemaking, which we will soon be able to release on the Embark program. Consistent with the 2023 NDAA, the Coast Guard Act also put in place a number of provisions to ensure additional safety at sea for all mariners. And we are partnered with the Coast Guard very closely in their enforcement of these regulations, which they are moving towards and some cases have already put in place, and our commitment to mariners to ensure their safety at sea. So we are closely linked, again, with our stakeholders. The Coast Guard in this context, Admiral Arguin and his team are making their way to all of the state maritime academies. He talks about this in many places where he has an opportunity, and he does it with CGIS Director Jeremy Gauthier. They are committed to driving sexual assault, harassment, bullying out of the industry. And so, you know, there have been many changes now requiring reporting. If a master is aware, they must report to the Coast Guard within 24 hours of time. But more to the point, the longer term change of the culture in the industry to drive out this kind of behavior and ensure that, again, mariners are valued for their professionalism and skill. Without that, we're going to struggle with retention across the board, whether it's women, men, or irrespective of gender, race, or any other discriminator. So we must change our culture and think differently. And back to the point about quality of life, we really need to think through how today's young people want to view themselves and can view themselves in this industry and how we can make changes to help continue their service and help them see that they have a career path. So there are a lot of factors that go there, mm-hmm. Go into that, but I think we have an opportunity in MARAD to perhaps start a dialogue there. One of the things we can do is convene. We can't direct, we don't regulate, but we can convene. Mm-hmm. And so this spring, we will be convening on Mariner Quality of Life, save the date, April 16th. Invitations for speakers going out soon, and all credit to Deputy Maritime Administrator Tamika Flack, who has grabbed this opportunity. Another women leader, yes. And her courageous leadership of this project, we want to have this dialogue. And I think when I talk about it with carriers, with labor, at opportunities where I have to speak, people agree change is necessary. Of course, they don't agree on what the changes should be, but that's the point of having a convening, so that we can move out on these topics and see what we can do to help improve capacity and opportunities for all mariners.
Yeah, it is a very complicated challenge facing a number of industries, and it's great to have your leadership on it. And I know that the American flag carriers, the American labor, are all very focused on tackling this problem.
Absolutely,
for
and it's a global challenge. Yeah. I mean, mariner shortfall is a global challenge, and of course, workforce development and challenges, shortfalls across transportation are global as well. But our mission is maritime, right? So that's what our focus
tackle
is.
Tackle our pieces of puzzle. Yep. Now let's turn to our favorite topic here on the podcast, the Jones Act. This administration has claimed to be the most pro-Jones Act administration in history. Tell us about how the administration is demonstrating its support for the Jones Act and American carriers and American mariners.
Well, I think the administration has been very vocal in its support for Jones Act and its support for Made in America broadly, and Jones Act as a part of that policy. President Biden issued an executive order in January of 2021, Executive Order 14005, on Made in America, and that our product should be made in America by America's workers, and how the Jones Act and the ability of our U.S. flag, U.S.-owned, U.S.-built carriers operating in the coastwise trade are a part of that process of being made in America. So the Jones Act is really critical for our economic and national security. It provides a vital service for our nation, certainly in the movement of goods coastwise and in our inland waterways and rivers. It provides national security in that context because we know all those mariners are U.S. citizens by and large, and there's some nuances to that tied to the flag requirements, but by and large, they are all U.S. citizens. Many of them are in good union labor jobs. And we don't have the challenge of having foreign entities managing our operations on our inland waterways and foreign mariners traveling and trading up and down our U.S. waters. The Jones Act is very similar to many cabotage laws around the world. Many other nations have similar laws, but what makes the Jones Act so unique is its internal stability. It's a competitive business within the business that it's in, and the opportunities that are here for trade and for employment for this nation. The Jones Act puts more than $72 billion into our GDP every year, employs more than 650,000 people across the maritime industry broadly. That's mariners, laborers, longshoremen, people that work in the port industry or related to the port industry. So it is a tremendous support network and national defense and security network, in addition to economic security network for this country. So it's critically important. The administration sees that, they value it, and frankly, that makes our job in the maritime industry much, much easier when we're dealing with labor, when we're dealing with Jones Act carriers, when we're dealing with all of the many challenges that go with the maritime industry. You know, they know that we support the Jones Act. And as an entering argument, we're coming in from that perspective, and it's just critically important for this country.
Yeah. I know for the mariners, for these American companies, having that kind of full-throated support really makes a lot in terms of stability of the industry, future hiring, you know, knowing that they have a career future. Having that kind of support is really, really critical.
But let's also talk about other things the Jones Act provides for us. The Jones Act provides stability in ship repair, in ship building, in ship maintenance. I mean, this is something that Secretary Carlos Del Toro, Secretary of the Navy, speaks about often, the need to continue to build this strong commercial shipbuilding industry, ship maintenance industry, ship repair industry, and that without a strong commercial base, we will not have the capacity, the technology, the workforce that we need to ensure our Department of Defense shipbuilding industry can continue as well. So he's an ardent advocate for this. He and Secretary Buttigieg, I think, are in agreement there. They both talked about this. We are certainly an ardent advocate for it as well, partnered with the Navy and are an ardent advocate for shipbuilding in this country. When you think about who is building large vessels in this country, mm-hmm. who is building LNG-powered vessels, those are all Jones Act built, right? Matson, Pasha, some of our carriers building LNG-powered container vessels at Keppel in Texas or ordering them from Philly shipyard in Philadelphia. We are building offshore wind vessels in yards in this country. Those will be Jones Act qualified vessels. So we're looking at, you know, we're looking to the future. We're looking to future technology. We're building new technology vessels. We're building modern ships. Look at the NSMV, one of the most modern training vessels that exists in the world really today. Those are being built in U.S. shipyards, and they're being built as Jones Act qualified vessels. So this is continuing to strengthen our industry. We just need to do more of it and continue to build that capacity so that we have what we need in times of crisis in support of our national defense as well. So really, really critical that we maintain this capacity and that we build upon it. And the Jones Act makes all of this possible. If Jones Act didn't exist, that capacity would either be lost or it would be in the hands of foreign entities with potentially with foreign workers. And our challenges would be very different. And we're really fortunate that we have such a strong capacity there.
Right. As a maritime nation, you really have to keep that shipyard capacity. You know, you mentioned visiting shipyards when you were in the Navy, and the Jones Act providing that stability for investors or for companies to build is really important. And the Jones Act isn't just shipyards. It's also the American mariner. I know you spend quite a bit of time doing giving away the World War II Merchant Mariner Veteran Congressional Gold Medal, which is a little history lesson for a lot of us. Can you tell us more about why it's important to have that pool of American mariners?
Well, a pool of American mariners gets to the same kind of baseline capacity in support of our national defense needs that that the Jones Act provides us. So we have to have vessels to be able to transport our cargo, particularly in the context of national security and national defense. We have to have cargo preference laws, cargo for those vessels to carry in order for them to have a business model that will allow them to succeed and continue in and support our growing industry. And we have to have mariners to man those ships. And if we don't have enough a pool of mariners and mariners don't see enough future in the industry, then we're challenged to have enough mariners to meet our needs in time of crisis. So we already know there's a mariner shortfall in 2017. Pre-COVID, a study was done by the Maritime Administration at the direction of Congress that showed that over the course of a six-month stand-up similar to Desert Storm in uncontested waters, and this just was really considering our Ready Reserve fleet, our U.S. flag fleet at the time, we were short about 1,800 mariners. Again, over a six-month period of time, mm-hmm. consistent operations and in uncontested waters. So along came COVID. COVID made things worse. Mariners found themselves stranded. They were not able to leave their ships. They didn't get reliefs. They were stranded overseas in shipyards. They were stranded other places in ports. People began to leave the industry by voting with their feet because they felt
it had been a hard life.
It was a very hard life already, and it became much harder and much more challenging. So we think we have somewhat turned the corner on the post-COVID challenges or challenges during COVID, but we still know we have a shortfall. And we've added more vessels to the U.S. flag fleet under the Tanker Security Program, which I mentioned earlier. This is a new program, again, supporting national defense needs, but we've added 10 more vessels to that fleet. And those vessels all need mariners to crew them as well. So there's a need to keep building
mariners
in our mariner capacity. And certainly, you know, our carriers tell us this all the time. Labor tells us this all the time. While they have seen a change and they have seen an improvement, vessels often sail short. Of course, they have to work this out with the Coast Guard because that's all a Coast Guard regulatory requirement. But they're still seeing challenges in retaining people and having enough people and having enough people in certain skill sets. So we continue to work on that. We have convened on it. We convened several years ago. Since then, we've worked with you, the Transportation Institute, and a whole host of stakeholders. You all have developed a series of recommendations. We are working on a Mariner Workforce Development Strategic Plan, which we hope will be signed out very soon. It's made its way all the way through the CHOP chain within OST, and so we hope to release that soon. And we've been fortunate that we also worked with a whole host of stakeholders, and we worked with you and your team and many other stakeholders from NDTA, from the Transportation Institute, and we think we're aligned where we can be in the context of recommendations to move forward, but it all comes down to how do you recruit, train, retain, and reduce barriers to entry. And I think we've talked about some of the things already in this podcast. We're really focused on retain, and that gets to the quality of life, and recruit, train, retain, and reduce barriers, safety at sea, the Embark program, and let's just keep going here to continue to build capacity here, because mariners want to see that they have a future. Yeah. They want to see that there's an industry there in place for them. They want to see that they can start out as a young mariner and then move on and move up if they care to, and that there are opportunities for them along the way. And if they don't see that, they leave. They leave. They vote with their feet. We've seen that. So we have an opportunity, I think, to make change there, and we certainly have a lot of interest from industry, labor, and many other stakeholders. So we appreciate all of that, and let's work together as partners to make progress.
Well, and the Jones Act is a big part of that, right? Because if you want these mariners available for wartime, they got to have peacetime.
They have to have peacetime opportunities.
Work, right. Other alternatives besides, you know, going to doing international travel. They need kind of that domestic commerce as well, America's marine highways, other opportunities locally in order to make sure.
A lot of places we see crossover. So there are plenty of Jones Act vessels that have to have unlimited licenses so they can make an easy transition to U.S. flag, privately owned internationally trading fleet if they care to. But we also need mariners to sail inland rivers and waterways. There's a whole different set of skill sets there, a whole different set of qualifications. Maybe they don't need an unlimited license, but they need a lot of other interesting, they need very different background, and it is by no means easy. And so a solid pool of mariners who want to take on that kind of challenge and are willing to be a part of that industry are absolutely essential to really back to our national economic and national security, right? We
absolutely.
Keep going back to the same
security.
Two things.
Yes,
right.
That's a big part of it.
It's a big part of it.
So what would you say to critics of the Jones Act who fail to see that value in a reliable, dedicated maritime industry?
Well, I think a lot of critics of the Jones Act like to take a sliver and say, oh my gosh, this thing at this time made this so much harder because of Jones Act. We have to follow Jones Act. But they ignore the $72 billion in GDP and the 650,000 jobs, the tremendous economic security provided by that, the tremendous national security provided, not only providing a baseline of capacity in the maritime industry, which we would not have otherwise, but also just providing security from the context of you have U.S. operated vessels safely operated, certified by our Coast Guard, our standards are very strong, with U.S. mariners running them. Again, our education, our labor schools, our union schools, our training for the maritime industry in this country is exceptional. Mm-hmm. It's very strong. So we have the safest vessels operated by well-qualified mariners, owned by U.S. Companies owned by U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would we not want this? Why would we not want this? And a lot of that is ignored in the context of piecemeal, this thing happened, this was a problem, you know, oh my gosh, it's a crisis, this Jones Act, it's driving up prices. It's not driving up prices. In many cases, we find much more stability in Jones Act prices. There's no competition in the industry. There's absolutely competition in the industry. It's a very solid, stable, and secure industry. If it were not, why would we have an entire club of people here, the Belmont Shipping Group, the Consultative Shipping Group, who meet annually to better understand and follow our Jones Act policies and practices. There's an interest in that from our foreign colleagues, who are delightful people. We love working with them. But they're very interested in the Jones Act because the Jones Act is very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And the success of that is success for American businessmen, American mariners, and American vessels, and American commerce. So why would we want to cede our success and pull out of something that brings so much to our economy and, again, to our national security?
Right, absolutely. Another thing you kind of mentioned was that stability and that supply chain resiliency as well that the Jones Act brings. We have this background of other nations like China or other ones that are looking to dominate global shipping. I'm sure they would love to dominate our inland waterway shipping. What do you see as the best response to those type of challenges to our supply chain resiliency?
Well, think about the national security challenge of Chinese owning ports up our Mississippi River, up into our agricultural communities, up into our broad waterways across and around the country. Think about the context of having foreign ships traveling up there, all of the security concerns that would be, foreign mariners traveling, all the security concerns that go with that, and just the access of our industry, our agricultural community, our shippers, our our industries broadly across the country to our waterways to ship our products where we want them to go. We have that with Jones Act. We would lose that if we opened up our rivers and our waterways to others. And I would also add, in times of COVID, we saw much more stability in Jones Act pricing than we did in pricing more broadly across the international industry. Sadly, 2% of our import-export commerce is delivered by U.S. flag. We have a very small but vital U.S. flag fleet in the international trading commerce world, privately owned vessels, not U.S. built, but U.S. owned, operated, and crewed. But if we had more control there, we'd have probably seen more stability amongst our carriers as well. However, with the Jones Act carriers, especially those trading blue water, we saw very consistent pricing there. So that is another plus, and really a good example of why shipping U.S. flag adds some value. And yes, for the security of getting your goods where you want them to go, you use Jones Act and you pay for that.
And you know what you're getting, yeah.
But you know what you're getting, you know when you're getting it, and you also have a very stable market. Yeah. So I think all of those things come together to show why it's absolutely essential that we retain control here and that we don't allow other nations, and particularly China, who we know is interested, to get a toehold here so that we then find ourselves challenged, both from an economic perspective and a national security perspective. The other thing I would add is we know China and many other nations pay stipends to subsidize their industries broadly. And I don't mean the very modest stipends that we pay to our U.S. flag as retainers, our internationally trading U.S. flag fleet as retainers, to ensure their availability for us, for the Transportation Command, for DOD in times of crisis. I mean major subsidies for the industry, for shipbuilding and for other responsibilities and requirements. We don't do that. We don't do that with Jones Act. There's no, the American public is not subsidizing Jones Act. It's operating on its own. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important point when you think about the value that this particular capacity brings to our country. Again, national security and economic value, and yet there is that we don't subsidize it, right? So we this provides us tremendous value. We want to keep it that way.
Absolutely. So as we close out, let's talk a little bit about America's maritime future. What are some challenges and opportunities you see coming down the road for American maritime and the Jones Act fleet in particular? You mentioned the NSMV, offshore wind, there's climate change issues. What do you see as coming next?
Well, there's a lot of opportunities for us in the context of, first of all, always an opportunity to grow the U.S. flag fleet. Tanker security program is an evidence of that. We have an authorization to go to 20 vessels there from the 10 that we have. We have some optimism. Maybe we'll have an appropriation that will match, and that will allow us to grow the U.S. flag fleet further. Growing the fleet incentivizes the need to keep carrying U.S. cargo, which is very important, and also incentivizes the need for more mariners. So people see a career path long term. There's plenty of opportunities here to think about culture, think about safety at sea, continue to grow our maritime workforce. I would add that, you know, building the new NSMV, tremendous recruiting tool. We have the newest and best training ships globally coming soon to 5 of the 6 state maritime academies, and the 6th is on the Great Lakes, and a different kind of vessel is needed there. So when they're ready to change out their training vessel, we'll work with them as well to decide what we do there. But these are tremendous recruiting tools, show that we can train our young mariners on the best and most modern vessels available. So tremendous opportunities there in the future. And of course, these are multi-mission vessels. They can also support other government entities in time of crisis, FEMA and others. They were built with that in mind. So opportunities there as well. And we're really excited about that. I think many opportunities to recapitalize our ready reserve fleet and support DOD needs, as well as, again, back to Secretary Del Toro and the you know, he does quite a bit of talking about this, as we do within DOT as well. And I think opportunities there continue to abound to expand our capacity in ready reserve and our sea lift needs nationwide, which is what the ready reserve fleet provides for DOT and DOD. Plenty of opportunities there. I think in the context of decarbonization, we're certainly seeing IMO make changes, which is driving some of our international privately owned carriers to make changes. And there's a tremendous interest across industry to think about decarbonization because it provides efficiencies and other things in the industry, and it gives people opportunities to upgrade vessels that they've, you know, things they've been wanting to work on for years. So, and I mentioned offshore wind and the connection with Jones Act and that vessels that are being built in this country. We have a program in MARAD Title 11, which provides loans for either shipyards or vessel construction, and we have designated vessels related to the offshore wind industry as vessels of national interest, which we may do under this program, which 2019 changed to the law. And so we are working with many companies who want to provide more capacity in the offshore industry, wind industry, so that we can help them provide opportunities, good faith and credit loans to help support that industry, which is growing. There have been some challenges lately, no question, but I think we still see the future moving forward in the offshore wind industry. There's quite a bit of opportunity in this country here, and there's quite a bit going on there. And it's Jones Act. Yeah. Back to the Jones Act.
More American jobs.
More American jobs, more need for American mariners, more need for technical skills for American mariners in the future and for American workforce to support this industry. So opportunities for growth there. I should talk about our META program within MARAD, the Maritime Environmental and Technical Assistance Program, and our new Maritime Center of Innovation that we were directed to stand up last year. We hope to get that. Actually, we've issued an RFI. We've solicited input from the public. We hope to have that online by 2024 this year. But lots of opportunities there to do more research to help industry in the context of decarbonization and ways to move forward. META's already developed a kind of a decarbonization understanding knowledge tool for carriers, operators, to understand what their emissions are and then what their choices might be to decarbonize and reduce their emissions as they prepare for new fuels and new opportunities. So lots going on there. Decarbonization, green corridors, lots of interesting green corridors, both inland and offshore in the international trading fleet. And so we're seeing a lot of change in the industry, but change in a good way, change that's going to provide more opportunities for shipbuilding, for building shipyard capacity, for building good jobs, good labor jobs, good Jones Act jobs, and a better and more modern maritime industry for our future. And we see a lot of excitement about that in the industry across operators. Challenges notwithstanding, we cannot grow tankermen tomorrow, but we can start.
Right.
We can start.
And it sounds like you all in your administration and the Biden administration is making good headway in making a lot of these opportunities.
We're making headway. There are still many headwinds. There are many challenges, but we're excited about the future. And we're thrilled, I think, to see collaboration across the industry, across many stakeholders that share that excitement and enthusiasm, and thrilled to have the opportunity to work in an administration that values Jones Act, that values labor, that gives us the opportunity to pull all these things together to move forward.
That's great. And before we close out, is there anything else about American maritime you want to mention?
Well, again, thank you for the collaboration and for the opportunity to be a part of your podcast and to tell the story of what MARAD is doing at all the places that we are active. It is a tremendously capable, talented group of people who want to do the right thing for maritime, who many of whom have spent their career in maritime in so many ways, and they've decided now to come into U.S. government and be a part of the Maritime Administration in support of the industry broadly. They really care about it. Many of them are still naval reservists. They sail. We've had people sailing recently on Cape Orlando and some other vessels that have gone off and done things in support of national security needs. And we're just thrilled to be a part of it, right?
They're taking care of us.
And so don't forget that people do all these things. And when it comes to MARAD, it's not a lot of people, but it's a lot of professional, highly skilled people who truly care about the future of the maritime industry and want to make it better.
Right, and are very, very dedicated.
No, they are.
So you have a great team, and it's going to be very inspiring leading a group of people who care so much and are real believers in American maritime power.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you, Sara.
Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time, and thank you for your service to our nation.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's all for this episode of the American Maritime Podcast. We hope that our audience will share this show and also visit AmericanMaritimeVoices.org and sign up to be a voice on maritime issues. Again, that's AmericanMaritimeVoices.org. Check it out. I'm Sada Fuentes signing off.